We've left off in Matthew 24. Last class, we spent some time introducing this chapter. We also, if you were in that class, passed out some handouts. With those handouts, we drew some parallels between Matthew 24 and especially Luke's account in Luke chapter 21. It will be helpful tonight and probably some other nights to have some people lined up with some of the parallel accounts. So we would like somebody on deck for Mark 13. We'll probably pull from that a couple of times. Jeff, if you'll stay ready with Mark 13. Steve, with your hand, Luke 21. That will be the third parallel, Luke 21. So we'll look at these as necessary. We picked up with Matthew 24, verses 1 and 2. Next time, Jesus went out from the temple and was going on his way, and his disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. But he answered and said unto them, "See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." If you had the chance to look at some of the videos that we looked at in the recent Vacation Bible School, you saw how large some of these stones were. We're not talking about stones, we're not talking about rocks. I mean, we're talking about huge masses of building material. And the temple was under construction for about 50 years before it was completed. We're talking about stones which weighed, you know, several tons and just at, you know, about 50 feet long and just really, really terrific. So when you think about those stones being stacked on top of one another, there's probably not going to be too much that would motivate people to try to rip those stones off. In fact, what probably is about the only motivation that would cause people to do that? All right, there's got to be something associated with, you know, great rage or probably vandalism. When you go back and you look at, and we touched on this a little bit in that last class, Herod, and he was not the only one, but Herod had put some gold into this structure. And if you can imagine a vine, not a literal vine, but a vine made of gold, and just one of the leaves on this great vine would be the size of a man. Big vine, just an individual leaf is at least the size of a man, and it's gold. Well, when you have the fire and that gold starts to melt between the bricks, and I mean, people are going to go ahead and have, because of that greed, they're going to have a great motivation to try to rip out those stones, and that's exactly what happened, among some other things. So that's why Jesus was able to say, predicting that one stone was not going to be left on top of one another. Then verse 3 brings us to new material. And he sat on the Mount of Olives. As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, "Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world?" As commentators look at this verse, oftentimes there's a great debate over how many questions the disciples ask. Some argue strenuously for two questions. Other people strenuously argue for the idea of three questions. And I'm not sure that that's really that important, because it may be that the disciples really didn't even know what they were asking. They were, it seems, a little misguided at this particular point. But we do know who came to see him on this specific point. Mark 13, verse 3. Let's look at the parallel.
And as he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter and James and John and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign where all these things are about to be accomplished?"
Now, here's one of the places where you see the value in looking at the parallel accounts. If you didn't look at Mark 13:3, you would assume perhaps that it was just a bunch of disciples and this was a very public matter. But Mark specifically tells us that we have four disciples, Peter, James, John, and Andrew, asking about this particular matter. As we divided the chapter last time, we're going to stick with that division throughout verses 1 through 35. We have information about the destruction of Jerusalem. Even though some of these verses may seem like they surely describe the end of time, I'm maintaining that they do not. Then in verses 36 through 51 of Matthew 24, information about Jesus' next and final return. Now, as we look at the questions in Matthew 24, verse 3, there are at least three ideas that seem to be involved. Number one, they're asking about the time. Tell us when this is going to be. They're also asking about the signs associated with the Lord's coming, plus they're asking for information about the end of the world. One of the things that poses a little difficulty for us is that the word that's translated age or world, ionos, it can mean either item. It can mean the end of the age, or it can mean the end of the world. So when the disciples ask this question, when's the end of, it could mean the end of the world. It could mean they were thinking that there's going to be a special age and when is this age going to end. But they were thinking that something was definitely going to end. I can't say for 100% certainty, but my inclination is to think that they were talking about the end of the world. When you look at these huge structures there, it was, if you're going to, you know, take, you know, just hundreds and hundreds of tons and you're going to rip the stones apart, I mean, what can be more dramatic than that? So, in my judgment, I think they're probably thinking about the end of the world. And when you look at the parallel accounts, Mark 13:4, Luke 21:7, these two passages also seem to kind of reinforce the conclusion that they were thinking about the end of time. But Jesus comes along and sort of dissects the apostles' questions, maybe even helps them clarify the questions just a bit, and shows that there are a couple of things that need to be thought through. Number one, the destruction of Jerusalem. Number two, the information about his next and final coming. One of the points that we've made at various times, and this point is applicable for tonight's lesson, when people talk about the coming of Christ, do you think they normally associate that with one thing, or do you think they, in their minds, think, well, okay, there are multiple comings associated with God or Christ in the Bible? One thing or multiple things do you think most people think about when we refer to the coming of Christ? I think most people do, and they're thinking about, you know, the end of time coming. When we look at the Bible, though, do we have emphasis on just one coming or several? We've got several. The Lord came, Matthew 20, verse 28. There was that initial coming. We've studied from the book of Revelation. Let's look at a couple passages here. Let's pick up, for example, with Revelation chapter 2:5, 2:16, and 3:3. Two helpers, the first will get two passages for us from Revelation 2, verses 5 and 16. Josh, Revelation 2, 5 and 16. Then from Revelation 3, let's look at the third verse. 3:3. All right, Tina. Josh, if you're ready, 2, 5, and then our Revelation chapter 2, verse 16 reference.
Remember, therefore, from where you have fallen, repent and do the works you did at first. If not, I will come to you and remove your lampstand from its place.
Okay. All right. Jesus said, do this or I'm going to come. Was he talking about his final coming at the end of time? No, couldn't have been. It was, this is a local congregation. You either fix it or I'm going to come. In what sense? I'm going to come in judgment. I'm going to come in the sense of punishment. All right, then a little later.
Therefore, repent. If not, I will come to you soon and war against them with the sword of my mouth.
Okay, the same kind of thing. I'm going to come. Well, not the second coming, but a coming in the sense of judgment. So he came in the sense, deity becomes flesh. You've got the two comings here. Revelation 3, verse 3. Okay, the same kind of idea here. So, multiple times, we've got a reference to Christ coming. We have to be very, very cautious about saying, well, here's a reference to Jesus coming, so it's got to be the end of time. No, that's not the case. We do know that he is going to come again. Hebrews 9, 27, 28 talks about, you know, death, and eventually the Lord's going to return. So there is that coming, but this word is a little broader than a lot of people would sometimes like to make it. Now, as we look at the disciples, their incorrect reasoning here, Jesus tries, as we said, to sort things out, verses 4 through 35, in talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, 36 through 51, talking about the end of time. And he also has this same discussion in the books of Mark and Luke. And I want to point out for you, I think it's Mark 13, 50, or Mark 13, 30, and then Luke 21, 32. Mark 13, 30.
Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place.
Do you remember how in the last class we just studied this from Matthew 24? But we pointed out this expression. Jesus said, how many of these things? All these things are going to take place when? Before this generation, his generation, passes away. So within the first century, we see it in Matthew. Matthew 24, I believe it's verse 34, is it not? Yeah, verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away till all these things be accomplished. Now we see it in Mark's account, Mark 13, 50. And let's look at Luke's account, Luke 21, verse 32.
Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away till all things be accomplished.
Okay, same idea. All things are all these things. Now when you have the Lord coming out three different times, in all three accounts, and he repeatedly says all these things are going to pass or take place within this generation, that's pretty significant. It is also a marker. It's also a way of telling us that as we look at the information prior to these verses, we're not dealing with things at the end of time. Now, we need that information for the reason in verse 4. Let's read it and then make a quick comment. Then we'll read it again and go through verse 6. And Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man do what? Lead you astray or deceive you. I think maybe the translation that Marcia had. Well, if we don't go and pay attention to the point that we just made, all these things are going to take place before this generation passes away. Do you think there's going to be the chance of being misled? Yeah. So God gives us, as I said, this huge road sign to say, watch out, do not be deceived. Okay, verse 4, and let's read through 6 now. And Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man lead you astray. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and shall lead many astray. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for these things must needs come to pass, but the end is not yet. Think about a major disaster, something that is really, really significant. I mean, we have tornadoes and hurricanes and maybe even some earthquakes, but think about something that is just so out of the ordinary that, I mean, it's just off the scale. When you have that kind of catastrophe, what are the kinds of reports that you get? You know, for example, let's say that New York was attacked. The initial reports, you know, back when we had the trade towers and that whole mess, 9/11. What about those initial reports coming in from, you know, Fox and CNN and MSNBC? They give out false information sometimes?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, and you can imagine what it was like prior to cable news and the internet and, the radio. So here Jesus is talking about one of the greatest disasters of all time, and it's occurring in a place that would have been regarded as a holy place for God. So Jesus warns his people in advance, expect false reports. Expect rampant information that is not true. So he's looking forward about 40 years to what took place with the city of Jerusalem, and he says, I want you to take heed. Now that's expressed with the present tense. In other words, it describes ongoing action. Jesus says, sometimes we'll watch. Person says, watch out tomorrow. Watch out today. And after today, after tomorrow is over, we forget the watching. But Jesus, as he talks about this watching, he says, you be on the lookout. You be mindful of what I'm telling you. It's going to take a while. But the Lord knew that this was going to come. And he says, you need to watch because it's possible for people to be led astray. And that word that's translated deceived, King James translation, or maybe it's closer to astray in your version, it describes the deliberate deception practiced by Satan and false teachers to mislead the world. We saw the same word, though I didn't mention it, when we were in Revelation chapter 12. John said Satan deceives the whole world. Well, he does that in a lot of different ways. He's been doing that for a long time, as we see here with the discussion on the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, when Jesus talks about this, and you'll see this in all three accounts, if you will also look at Mark 13 and Luke 24, Jesus says how many were going to be making false messianic claims? Many. A lot of people. Once again, when he gives us this detail in all three accounts, it's a way of saying this is very, very important. What was the claim that people were going to make? People were going to be saying, all right, I am the Christ. That might mean a couple of things. It might mean I am the Messiah for the Jewish world. In other words, people would be claiming to do what Jesus does. Or there could be this claim. And I kind of favor the second claim, but I can't be for sure. If you didn't want to make the first claim as far as saying, well, I'm, you know, this new guy on the block and I'm the Messiah, what could you have made as far as a second and counterclaim? Maybe even more powerful. Well, okay, they could have been making that. Okay, they could have been making that, but was there a third one maybe? What happened to Jesus, Acts 1? Where'd he go? All right. Somebody wanted to be a false prophet, they could have said, guess what? I went up. I'm back. I'm back on the earth. And now you have a chance to see me again. You think that might be tempting to some people? So Jesus says, beware. Jesus says, do not be deceived. And he says, you always be on the lookout for these kinds of characters. And then Jesus goes on to say a little bit more. He says, when these fakers begin to show up, it will be time for Jerusalem to be punished. And he says at that point, the time is what? Do we not have the words at hand? Let's see. Okay, maybe we had that in the parallel account that I drew from. You see that, Steve or Jeff?
ASV, but the end is not
Okay, but nothing, the time is at hand, go not after them?
No.
Okay. Well, I got that from somewhere. I'm going to have to go back and look at that. But there is this clear warning, and it's so important. Jesus, as you look at verse 23, and also in verses 25 and 26, you see the same warning. Then if any man shall say unto you, lo, there is the Christ, or here, believe it not. And then in 25 and 6, behold, I have told you beforehand, if therefore they shall say unto you, behold, he is in the wilderness, go not forth. Behold, he's in the inner chambers, believe it not. Very, very specific and very, very emphatic on this. Don't know exactly what these guys were promising, but surely some of it was safety, maybe even prosperity. Don't worry about the Romans, and maybe even they're talking about an earthly kingdom. Well, these people were making these kinds of promises, but when we look elsewhere in the New Testament, what do we know about the Lord's next and final coming? When he returns, what's this going to be like? What will it be like? All right, it's going to be a thief in the night, so all of these ideas that we find here in the first part of Matthew 24, it tells us that that can't refer to that time. Anything else? 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, Jesus is going to descend in what kind of fire? Flaming fire. Who's going to be with him, remember? The angels. Well, if he descends from the heavens in flaming fire, he's got all the angels with him. You think there's going to be any doubt about him coming back? Absolutely not. Every person is going to know. And then you have this little detail. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 52. His descent is going to be like the shout, like the voice of the archangel. Find that in Thessalonians. And then in the twinkling of an eye, we shall be changed. Just like that. Well, when you compare that to Matthew 24, it just doesn't jive. And this is additional information that helps us understand he's not talking about his second and final coming. Then in verse 6, and we'll see after we get through this if you have something that you'd like to ask. Jesus said, my disciples, as you go through this period, what are you going to hear about? You're going to hear about wars. And you will also hear about rumors of wars. But Jesus says, as you hear this information, it should not cause you to be troubled. In fact, he says, this has to come to pass. It's necessary. It's the word that describes a triangle when we say it must have three sides. So the Lord said, you mark it down. You be confident in the fact that, you know, we're talking about a situation here that's going to be associated with these specific signs. Now, anybody know what the state of the world was like when Jesus spoke these words? Rome was in power. Time of peace, a time of war. Well, for the most part, war was coming, but for the most part, as you look at Rome during this time, they were in a state that was fairly peaceful. Now, yeah, there was no war as far as Rome is at odds, you know, with this particular culture, right? You do have persecution. A lot of that came from the Jewish people, but as far as actually the battlefield, for the most part, things are pretty quiet. Now, imagine you can take maybe the financial markets. You're going through a period where things are, you know, looking up for folks, and somebody says, hey, the time is going to come when things are really going to fall apart. You're going to be broke if you stay in the stock market, or vice versa. Well, you know, things are just going up and up and up, and all the indicators look positive. You would think, well, that seems kind of odd. You're going counter to all the signs that we see. And that really was what Jesus was saying here. It may look like it's peaceful. Everything may seem quiet. And Rome had enjoyed a long period of peace. But Palestine, other parts of the Roman Empire, were about to become involved with not only strife, but it was going to be a type of strife where literally tens of thousands of people lost their lives. Now, when you go from a state that's relatively peaceful to a state where thousands of people are dying, and there's no indication, at least at this point, that that's going to happen, that is pretty amazing. Thinking about how people act. Today, when there's a big war, you think about, and you probably don't have the age to remember this, but you think about World War I, or you think about World War II. Do you suppose that people were thinking this is the end?
Especially in the early days.
Yeah. They got tanks, and they've got this bomb, and they've got this thing, and that's going to be the end. Well, do you think that's a new thought? No. People have been thinking that kind of thing for a long time. When a war comes up, and these thousands of casualties start to flow in, and people begin to, deal with the dead, and the reports begin to flow in, people were thinking, well, this is the end. Well, it wasn't the end, as far as the end of the world. Looking ahead just a little bit, down there in verse 16, Jesus said, this time's going to come, and let them that are in Judea run where? Flee. You can flee into the mountains, and you can find safety. So this all deals with the destruction by Rome in 70 AD.
Jesus...
Jesus also used the present tense when he talked about being troubled. He said, don't be troubled. Present tense, ongoing action. So as all this stuff begins to unfold, Jesus says, God has it in hand. I've told you about this in advance. Don't worry about it. These things have to occur, and they're going to happen. Don?
Maybe I'm slow on the uptake, but are you saying all of chapter 24 has to do with the destruction of Judah?
Down to 35 and 36. And then after you get to 35 and 36, we switch over to the second coming. 14?
And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. At 70 A.D., it wasn't proclaimed to all the nations yet.
Well, like I say, I don't want to get too far ahead as far as... Let's just take a cross-reference. Let's look at Colossians 1. Verse 23. Colossians 1:23, Who'd like to read it? Lois?
If indeed you continue in the faith firmly established and steadfast, and not moved away from the hope of the gospel that you have heard, which was proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, was made
famous. Okay, now we'll say a little bit more about verse 14 a little later. But when the book of Colossians was written, it was well before 70 A.D., and Paul, as he writes this letter, what's he say about the gospel? Was it preached? It was. He says it was preached to every creature under heaven. And we'll, like I say, develop that a little bit more. But when we look at these passages in Matthew 24, prior to verses 35 and 36, Jesus makes it clear. He says all these things will happen within this generation. So when you look at passages like this, I think we can find some other verses in the New Testament that allow us to say, okay, he was right. Don?
It says, proclaim to all creation, not to all creatures. So
okay.
All creation at that time.
I'll
listen to you more.
Okay, well, I think the point that I was trying to make, he says, in the whole world. In verse 9. The footnote in the ESV says, the inhabited earth. And then in Colossians 1, Paul says the gospel, which was preached, basically worldwide. So, but we'll come back to that. But like I say, I do want to avoid getting too far ahead. Let's just take these point by point and bear in mind what the Lord has said in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21 about the things taking place before that generation ended. Because we can really run amok and tie up some time. I think that's probably better spent developing it. Point by point. Okay, as we think about what we've got here, there was an interesting series of events that happened with Rome. You have, as I mentioned, this peace that had been going on for a long time. You've got Nero. He was that really bad guy that died in about 60 AD. And after Nero's death, that's real close to AD 70, the time that Jerusalem was destroyed. After Nero's death, you have three more emperors, three more Roman leaders that in quick succession go. I mean, unless we have somebody assassinated today, we generally have leaders sticking around for a while. But they died very quickly, and there was a fellow by the name of Vespasian. He comes into power. And Vespasian had a son whose name was Titus. And it's Titus who ends up going to Jerusalem to attack it. So it's kind of interesting. You have this quick succession there shortly before 70 AD, and everything just falls into place. So Rome does come. And as I said, within that generation, you have those kinds of things happening. Well, Jesus, as he looks at this, he predicts that there's going to be this military problem as far as the wars, the rumors of wars. As you look at verse 7, you also see political turmoil, which was also part of this time. Nation was going to rise against nation. A kingdom was going to rise against kingdom. There were going to be famines and there were going to be earthquakes in various places. And then you come to that point, which is one of the reasons why people say, well, we must be dealing with the end of time. He says, where's the word end? I know we saw it. Okay, it's at the end of verse 6. All these things must need come to pass, but the end is not yet. Don't we sometimes use the word end in a very loose way? We say, well, the good times are over. Well, what do we mean by that? Absolutely? No. But here, even though you see that word, and I can see why a lot of people would look at this particular passage and they would say it must refer to the end of time, that's not it. He's talking about the end there of Jerusalem's existence, the destruction of the old economy and so forth, not a reference to Jesus' next and final term. The wars, the rumors of wars, they've always been, as far as our world, things have existed, but they're not a sign for the end. We know that because as you look at verses 36 through 51, Jesus, as he's talking about a second coming, he doesn't list any signs. No wars, no rumors of wars. And yet people will sometimes point here, or they'll go over to Revelation 16, verse 16, and say, well, we've got the wars, rumors of wars in Matthew 24. We've got the Battle of Armageddon over here in Revelation chapter 16, and there's going to be Russia, and it's going to involve China, and there's going to be this great nuclear holocaust and all that stuff. And that's not what Jesus was talking about. If that were to happen, that's not something that we can predict from the Bible. Anything that you might add or ask before we pick up with 7 and 8? Okay. Let's move a little more deeply into the text. For nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and earthquakes in divers places. But all these things, Jesus says, not the end, but he says they are the beginning. They're the start of the travail. Then shall they deliver you up into tribulation, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all the nations for my namesake. We have there in verse 6, war. We have information about rumors of wars. And now Jesus turns to the subject of political unrest. He talks about nations, and there's going to be one nation that rises against another. There's going to be one kingdom that rises against another. He refers to famines. He refers to earthquakes. In Luke 21, verse 11, the parallel account, he even says these earthquakes were going to be great. But then, if you look at Luke's account, Luke's parallel, Luke 21, 12, and Matthew gives us a hint of this, but notice what Luke says as well. 21, 12.
For all these things they shall lay their hands on you, and shall persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons, bringing you before kings and governors for my name's sake.
Okay, they're going to deliver you up to the synagogues. Well, does that kind of give us a clue as to what time we're talking about? Anybody worried about being delivered up to a Jewish synagogue now? I mean, hard to find one. Let alone find one that's going to hurt you. But if you're in the first century, prior to 70 AD, when you begin to look at the book of Acts and you see how the Jews persecuted God's people, were the synagogues a place of distress and persecution for Christians? They were. You find, and we saw this on the video, remember they talked about the Jews? They went a couple hundred miles or so to stir up strife and trouble for Paul. So it's once again another way of saying, as we look at this information prior to verse 34, the Jewish synagogues, the Jewish councils, throughout the book of Acts, prior to 70 AD, they did all of these things. The Lord also talks about famines, lack of food. He refers to pestilences. That, of course, would be a reference to plagues, political unrest, and the persecution. But these were signs that the end of Jerusalem's existence was coming to a head, but it's not a sign about the end of time. Then in verse 8, Jesus talked about these things. He says they're going to lead up, they're going to be the beginning of the travail. What's the image here? He talks about the travail. Some other translation might word it a little differently. All right, sorrow. Anybody else have something besides these two things?
Birth pains.
All right, that really helps. When you think about birth pangs, we're talking about a woman, she goes into labor. Labor, the worst part of it? It's just the beginning. Labor tells you some other things are down the road. Labor is just the sign to say the process is underway. But the big moment is going to come a little bit later. Well, Jesus says this was the same thing that was true in the case of Jerusalem. There were going to be some things that led up to it. There was going to be the political unrest from those Roman rulers. There were going to be, in addition to the wars and the rumors of wars, there were going to be famines, and there were going to be diseases and other great signs. Luke 21, verse 11 is a parallel. Let's take a look at it, if you would, please. Luke 21, 11.
And there shall be great earthquakes in diverse places, famines and pestilences, and there shall be terrors.
Okay, great signs from heaven. Once again, a lot of people will say, well, that's got to refer to the end of time. Remember what we said about the end of time? 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, when it's time for the Lord to show up at the end of time. Is he going to be doing great signs up there? No. He's going to descend. We're going to be changed. How quickly? Like the blink of an eye. So when you look at other passages in the New Testament, they also remind us that we are not dealing, even though we're talking about great signs from heaven, these are the great signs, the famines, the earthquakes, and so forth. In fact, if you look down a little later in the chapter, verse 36, but of that day, talking about a different day, an hour, knows no man, not the angels of heaven, neither the Son. And then he says in 37, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall be the coming of the Son of Man. Verse 38, for as in those days which were before the flood, what were they doing? Eating and drinking. Were they looking at various signs that said, hey, the end is coming? Life seemed absolutely normal. So as Jesus talks about his future return, he goes out of the way. Three different accounts. And gives us multiple indications to say that when he's talking about his coming, there are no signs. And thus, when we see these signs earlier in the chapter, it does not describe the end of time. You also see this, I think. Let's get some readers here. Who'd like to be our Matthew 24 reader? We'll also pick up somebody for these verses. All right, Gary. Matthew 24, and then we'll read Mark 13:8. Do you want to start with Matthew 24, Gary? 24, verse 8.
All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted and shall kill you, and ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended and shall betray one another and shall hate one another. And many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold.
Okay, that's enough. Thank you. Mark 13:8.
Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. These are the beginning.
Okay, now if you listen to both Matthew 24 and Mark 13:8, you heard the word beginning. It's rare that something just that's this significant will happen just like that. So Jesus, as he talks about the destruction of Jerusalem, he said that there was going to be a beginning. Just think of a ramp. You start down at the base of the ramp, and Jesus said there are going to be some preliminary things. And that's why you need to watch. That's why you need to beware. Because people are going to make some things out of this that are simply not true. So there's this initial point. Then we see, as we look from Luke 21, verse 20, there's what we might refer to as a middle period. Steve, that's you, isn't it? Luke 21, verse 20?
When we see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that her desolation is
in. Okay, now that passage is really helpful for a couple of reasons. Jerusalem. There's the place that we're talking about. He said it was going to be compassed about. It was going to be encircled by armies. Well, who are those forces going to be? Not the Soviet Union. Not the United States. Who were they? Rome. So that would be the middle period. Jesus said there's some things that are pointing towards this period. You can look, you can see these signs. And a time is going to come when Jerusalem is actually encircled. Jerusalem is actually being attacked. And then you have verses 29 to 31, what I would refer to as the end period. And Gary, let's go back to you. Matthew 24, 29 to 31.
Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with the great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other.
All right. I know, as with some of the other passages prior to verse 34, that people look at these verses and say, well, it's got to refer to the end of time. Well, it's before verse 34 where Jesus said all these things are going to take place within this generation. Rather than describe the end of time, we've gotten to the beginning of Jerusalem's destruction. We have looked at the middle of Jerusalem's destruction for Luke 21, verse 20. And now Jesus pictures here the end of Jerusalem's destruction. Figurative language to describe what was going to happen to the city. This was a great, great problem, a great, great battle. In fact, if you look ahead a little bit to verse 21, Jesus said, for then shall be a great tribulation such as hath not been from the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall be. If you let your mind really contemplate this passage, Jesus says, out of all the world tragedies, looking through human history, he said, this is really as bad as it's going to get. If that statement is true, then I think that does a lot as far as help us understand why he uses this language, which most people would associate with the end of the world. So when we look at what happened to Rome, it was destroyed compared to what happened to Jerusalem. It really was insignificant. And that's true for any other devastation that's taken place. As we look at our time, people will many times look at earthquakes or look at famines and they'll say, well, look at how bad this is. But if we actually go back and look at history, a lot of the stuff that people say is really bad today, it's not all that bad. Did a little looking as far as earthquakes. There are approximately 1.5 million earthquakes every year. I didn't realize there's over a million earthquakes every year. Only about 15,000 of those can be detected with scientific equipment. And we also, as we look at the world, find that there are some places that have special earthquake zones. For example, out there on the coast, we've got the Pacific Ocean, special earthquake zones there, Middle East, the Mediterranean, and so forth. And as you go back and you look at human history prior to 70 AD, some of the places that we've talked about in the Revelation class, we've got a lot of earthquake activity. Crete, Smyrna, Miletus, Laodicea, Hierapolis, Colossae, Rome, Judea. History has a lot of information about earthquakes during this time, and that's also consistent with what Jesus talked about. People today, when we see earthquakes out in California and things, will say, well, look at how bad the quake was. And then we've got war over here, and we've got poverty over here, and we've got crime. The Lord must be about ready to come. Once again, if you go back and you look at history, you find that what people are pointing to today is really not all that bad compared to what we've faced in the past. I mentioned one time the New Madrid earthquake. That was on December 16, 1811. It devastated more than 40,000 square areas of land, created a 20-mile long lake, and changed the course of the Mississippi River. You've got shocks from this particular quake. They caused the Mississippi to flow backwards in some places. Now think about that. The Mississippi is a giant river. And for an earthquake to actually cause that river to flow backwards for a while, people thought that the end was coming. You know, this is the end of time. The Lord's going to appear. There were reports about this event. They said that the Mississippi shrunk from its banks, created a 20-foot ridge of water. Imagine that, a 20-foot high bank of water that flooded the countryside. Mile-long cracks in the earth spewed out sand, rock, sulfurous fumes. In some places, the ground rose 20 feet. There are even reports about whole forests sinking into the earth. And as we look at this kind of stuff, it's very easy, especially with today's communication, to point to various things on the earth and say, well, this is taking place and this has got to signify the end. But as you go back and you look at human history, you often find that there have been similar events that were many times worse than what we find today. And just no signs to tell us when the Lord is going to come back. Things that you want to add or ask over what we've said tonight. Okay. Well, as you pick up, got kind of a bad grade break. He says there in verse 8, as we mentioned, all these things are just the beginning of the travail, and then the tribulation and so forth in 10. I'm going to break it off there because that's just not a good beginning point for next time.
I've heard some people say we're not going to know the day and the time, but we're going to know the season. Where did they pick that up?
I think you come back here to where Jesus talks about, for example, the earthquakes and the famines, and they would say, well, we can't pinpoint the exact era, but we do have these things taking place today. And because we have famines and earthquakes and we've got plagues and those kinds of things, we're in the last time. We're in the last season. But when you go back,
the quake that is far as a time of not specifically like a
right
spring, fall, summer type thing with an age or a generation.
Yes. And you probably could make a case for spring, summer, winter, fall. For example, it's going to be sometime in the spring, and you say that's going to be a 3 or 4 month period. But you're right in exactly how you describe that. The problem with that is, when you go back and you look at earthquakes, when you go back, you've got information about earthquakes in the Bible. You have information about famines in the Bible. So if that's your argument, you find throughout human history all these things. So if that's your argument...
Well, there was a great famine in the Depression era, too.
Yeah.
The Dust Bowl in that part of the country. And we, what, even last summer, we experienced...
with the rain?
Very dry parts in the
There are earthquakes.
Yeah.
It's all there. So if that's your proof, how do you isolate this generation from the previous hundreds and thousands of years? It just doesn't make sense. But there are people who do try to get around that and say, we're not predicting a specific date or even a year, but we're in that general time period. And you find that these fellows will often say, if somebody likes predicting a stock market crash, the market's going to crash. Well, okay, and it's going to be soon. If you predict that long enough, you're eventually going to get it right. Anybody else? Don?
Okay, I'll save it next because I'm jumping away ahead of you. I don't want to do that.
Okay, we've got a couple minutes, so let's see how far you are on the diving board.
Well, as Betty was saying that, the lesson of the victory, you're saying this basically is related to the destruction of the temple. The victory?
The victory.
The fig tree.
The fig tree, okay.
But it does say that general terms that it could be the summer. So it says as if it's a fig tree is putting out tender shoots, then the time is near. Mm-hmm. Now what is near? Is it months or is it years or is it what?
Okay. So, there again, if we look at verse 34, where Jesus says, all these things.
Understand that.
Oh, okay. So he's got to be, if you look at verse 34, he's got to be talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And as he says, and that's why I went through the beginning, the middle, and the end. For example, when you...
Destruction of Jerusalem, what season was that when it started? I know it's a seed, so it's up all the time.
I'd have to go back and look at the exact time of year, Don. Offhand, I do not remember that. But I would understand the fig tree as saying, the idea there is that the branches are full of sap. You can tell, based on the sap, based on how the branches look, that it's about time.
It becomes tender and puts out its leaves.
Right. Yeah. You have signs out in nature. For example, you look at the garden. You can go out there and say, okay, it's about time to harvest the potatoes. Carrots are about ready to go. We've got those indications. And that's why he gives all these signs here when you look at the destruction of Jerusalem. It's going to be there in the beginning stages. You're going to hear about the wars, the rumors of wars. You're going to get to the point where you've got the city of Jerusalem encircled. And at that point, there's no doubt about what's taking place. And then eventually the city's going to fall. But just those warnings again and again to help the people understand what was taking place. So we'll spend a little more time on that when we get a little further into the chapter. So